I'm Tanzina Vega, and this is The Takeaway.
The result of the ballot held this evening is that the Parliamentary Party does have confidence.
Yeah! I have confidence in sunshine. I have confidence in rain. I have confidence that spring will come again. Besides which, you see, I have confidence in me.
On Wednesday, British Prime Minister Theresa May survived a no-confidence vote called by members of her own Conservative Party. That means she'll stay in power as the messy Brexit story continues to unfold.
We now need to get on with the job of delivering Brexit for the British people and building a better future for this country.
Theresa May speaking outside 10 Downing Street Wednesday night. May's two-year tenure as Prime Minister has been almost entirely defined by the wild and rancorous road to Brexit. After backing off a vote on a deal that angered hardliners earlier this week, she'll now try once more to find a way forward before the March separation deadline.
A Brexit that delivers on the vote that people gave.
Rosa Prince is with me to talk about May's career and leadership to this point and to help us understand a little bit more about the woman behind the premiership. Rosa is a political journalist and author and Theresa May's biographer. Rosa, thanks so much for joining us.
Thank you for having me on.
So let's start. May continues to has survived the no confidence vote. What did you make of that outcome for her?
Well, look, it wasn't a great outcome. She lost a third of her backers, more than a third of her own MPs. These are MPs from her party, didn't vote for her. So although she does fight another day, and they've rather weakened their own position because under the rules they now can't challenge her again for another year, she kind of is limping on. She's wounded. She's been like this for a while now. And the big takeaway, I think, from yesterday was that to ensure that she won that vote, she had to make a big concession, which was that she agreed she would not fight the next election. So she's kind of a dead woman walking, really.
That's a pretty intense thing to be, especially in this moment. I'm wondering if we can go back a little bit. How has she defined herself as a politician more broadly?
Well, I think she very much sees herself as a pragmatist and almost a technocrat. She's not one of these people like a Ronald Reagan or a Margaret Thatcher who came into politics because she had a vision of how she wanted to change the country. I think Theresa May's real reason for serving is because she thinks she could do a good job. I think she wants to kind of have the handles of state at her control and just run things well. I think that's really her defining mission. So it's quite an interesting thing. I think you do get politicians breaking down into two groups, and she's very much in that pragmatist, do what's best, consensus. Unfortunately for her, she's found herself in politics at a time when ideology is really driving things.
You've sort of been really thrust into this role with Brexit as well. So, Rose, I want to zoom in forward a little bit and look at her vision for Brexit. How has it evolved? I think a lot of us are over here watching what's happening, and it's a very confusing story in and of itself. But what's her vision been?
Yeah, it's one of those things that you sort of almost shy away from it because it's so complicated to get into. Most mainstream politicians were opposed to Britain leaving the European Union. And Theresa May was a mainstream politician. She was the Home Secretary in the last government. So she, I don't think she, as I say, she's not an ideologue. I don't think she believed fervently in the European project, but I think she felt economically and for lots of other reasons, it was pretty much the best thing to stay. Unfortunately for her, the public disagreed, and the referendum that was held ensured that Britain would be leaving the EU. And she very much came to power as the Prime Minister who was sensible, a good pair of hands who would steer the country through that. And I think what happened then is she almost set out to prove herself. She wanted to show that she could do Brexit. She wanted to reassure particularly those in her own party who were determined to get Britain out of the European Union that she was the person to deliver it. As time went by, though, the repercussions of that became ever clearer. And it would be if Britain suddenly left the EU with no ensuing trade deal or no arrangements, all sorts of things would happen. I mean, the airplanes wouldn't be able to take off. There would be no food delivered. Medicines would run out. There are real problems here. So because she's a pragmatist, she kind of almost swung back again and tried to get some arrangements going on that would make for an easier transition. The trouble there, of course, is that by then she had built up expectations that British sovereignty would be restored entirely. So when she announced this rather pragmatic deal, she let people down. And that's what's happening now. It's her own side who are turning on her saying, you promised us what they call a hard Brexit. What's happening?
What about the public? How has she been viewed by the public?
It's interesting. I think at the beginning, they were a little wary of her. She had a general election last year, which did not go well. If you remember, the Conservative Party used to have a majority in the House of Commons, and they lost that. They're being propped up by a small Northern Irish party. So she was rather reviled for a while there. Over the last year or year and a half, her poll ratings have actually been going up. It's a funny relationship, I think, the public have with her. It's almost like the more knocks she takes, and she really is taking a lot of knocks from her own party, from other EU leaders, it's more like they sort of admire her resilience. She just doesn't seem to let it get to her. She keeps going. She remains calm. She's quite a dignified presence on the world stage. And the public, obviously, everyone has their own politics, but people talk about how personally they rather feel sorry for her and kind of admire her. Whether or not they believe in her politics is sort of a side issue. As a person, she seems to attract some warmth these days.
And she's also announced that she's going to stand down before the 2022 elections. Was that a surprise to you?
It wasn't a surprise. I think she did so badly in the last election, it was sort of understood that she wouldn't be allowed by her party to fight another one. I think what it is a big disappointment to her, because all she has done during her premiership is Brexit. She came to office with some hopes of actually achieving something. She wanted, as all prime ministers, presidents the world over want, she wanted a legacy. She wanted to have something in the history books other than the word Brexit. And if she is now being forced out, which is what's happening, then that's not going to happen. So I think it will be a disappointment to her. So it's not a surprise, but I think it does change things for her.
Rosa Prince is a political journalist and author of Theresa May, The Enigmatic Prime Minister. Rosa, thanks so much for coming in.
Thank you.
More than 60,000 people have died in Yemen's civil war since 2015. The United States has supported the Saudi government throughout the war, which over the years raised little opposition in Congress. But the brutal murder of Saudi journalist Jamal Khashoggi put the spotlight back on the crisis. And on Wednesday, the Senate voted to advance a debate about a resolution demanding an end to U.S. military support for Saudi Arabia's involvement in Yemen. But on the same day, the House took a different approach, passing a rule that prevents the House from voting on any resolution on Yemen throughout the end of this term. Andrew Desiderio is a congressional reporter for The Daily Beast, and he's going to help us understand. Andrew, thanks for joining us.
Thanks for having me.
So, okay, can we unpack what happened in the House? I mean, did the House essentially vote to gag themselves?
Essentially, they did so, but till the end of this calendar year. They can bring it up when Democrats retake control in January, but at least for this calendar year, they're not going to be able to take any action procedurally on a similar resolution.
Now, can you give me a little sense of why? I mean, was this some sort of political cover? Like, why would they wait?
Well, I think it's partly Republicans giving the president political cover and giving cover especially to Secretaries Pompeo and Mattis, because those two have come to Capitol Hill many times to urge lawmakers not to take these steps. And I think it's partly a last-minute power play by Republicans. As I mentioned before, Democrats will take over control of the House come January, and this is their last time to really thumb their nose in the face of Democrats while they really can.
Let's talk a little bit about what the Senate did. Is this a symbolic move, or why even do what they did when the House has ensured that it really can't go anywhere?
So the thinking is that this gives them some legislative momentum in a way that if and when House Democrats bring up a similar resolution come January when they have control, Senate Democrats can then force a vote on whatever the House passes via what's called a privileged resolution. A privileged resolution is one of the rare ways in which the minority in either chamber can actually force a vote without the consent of the majority.
What specifically motivated the Senate to bring forward this resolution?
So, you know, if you talk to different senators, you'll get a different answer on that. Obviously, the murder of journalist Jamal Khashoggi was super important for them and certainly flipped a lot of Republicans to yes on a resolution like this. But you'll talk to other senators and they'll put up photos of the humanitarian crisis in Yemen, photos showing little kids starving to death, There's a major cholera outbreak in the country right now. It truly is a humanitarian disaster. And I talked to Senator Chris Murphy about it yesterday. He's one of the co-sponsors of the resolution. He said what really did it for many of his Democratic colleagues who were on the fence was the bombing of a school bus in August that killed, I believe, 29 kids. So a lot of innocent civilians have been in the crosshairs of this brutal civil war. And I think the bus bombing, and Senator Murphy believes this too, is what did it in for a lot of senators.
How significant is it for Congress to try and check military actions?
It's hugely significant, and it's also very rare. The last time Congress really asserted itself on war powers was in 2001 and 2002 with the authorizations for the use of military force directly after 9/11. But the issue has been, and this has been something expressed by Republicans and Democrats, that both the Bush and the Obama and now, of course, the Trump administration have all really exploited those authorizations for the use of military force and have used them to legally justify other incursions into other countries.
And do you expect the issue to come back up in the new year?
I do. Democrats in the House have stated their intention to act on a similar resolution. And if and when that happens, you can expect Senate Democrats to do what they're doing this time, which is use a what's called a privileged resolution, which allows them, as members of the minority, to force a vote on almost anything.
Andrew Desiderio is a congressional reporter for The Daily Beast. Thanks, Andrew.
Thank you.
Hey, you, yeah, you, podcast person, Amy Walter here. I'm host of Politics with Amy Walter from The Takeaway. And I'm interrupting your listening pleasure right now with an important message. Don't worry, it's only going to take a few seconds, and I promise we'll get right back to the show. I wanted to invite you to come along with me every week for an insider's view of Washington. I'm going to take you beyond the headlines for a deeper understanding of how Washington works, who's pulling the levers of power, and how it all impacts you. Just search for Politics with Amy Walter in your podcast app and subscribe. It's as easy as that.
Go to OmahaSteaks.com and enter code TAKEAWAY into the search bar to get 74% off Omaha Steaks Family Gift Package, now only $49.99. Order now and you'll get 4 hand-cut aged-to-tenderness top sirloin steaks, 2 savory premium pork chops, 4 chicken fried steaks, 4 Omaha Steaks burgers, 4 snappy kielbasa sausages, all beef meatballs, 4 perfectly browned potatoes au gratin, 4 made-from-scratch caramel apple tartlets, plus get 4 more burgers for free. Again, just go to OmahaSteaks.com, type takeaway into the search bar, and add the family gift package to your cart. Don't wait. Order today.
Tanzina Vega back with you on The Takeaway. And we're going to continue our look at labor in the United States, but we're shifting the focus now to one group that's always operated on the fringes: undocumented workers. As of 2016, there were 7.8 million undocumented workers ages 18 and older in the United States labor force. Last week, the New York Times published a look at the undocumented workers employed by the Trump National Golf Club. But these workers aren't just employed in the service economy. Undocumented workers build our homes, farm our fields, the list goes on. Mark Hugo Lopez has the data on all of this. He's the director of global migration and demography research at the Pew Research Center. Welcome, Mark.
Thank you.
And here to help us contextualize some of these numbers is Kathleen Caron, the executive director of Justice in Motion, an organization that works to protect migrant worker rights across North and Central America. Kathleen, thanks for joining us.
It's wonderful to be here. Thank you.
So, Mark, let's start with you. Let's get a sense of the actual numbers around this. I mentioned there were 7.8 million undocumented workers in the U.S., but that figure is actually down. Can you give us a sense of how far down it is and where it was before and sort of why these numbers in your research are declining?
So, yes. So we last saw a peak in the number of undocumented workers in the United States back in 2007, right before the Great Recession, when the number hit 8.2 million. And that's an estimated 8.2 million undocumented workers in the country. They also at that time made up a larger share of the overall workforce at about 5.4% then compared to 4.8% now. generally speaking, the population of undocumented immigrants in the United States has been in decline, largely because of a decline in the number coming from Mexico. So you've seen a decline in the number of people both arriving in the United States without authorization, but also an increase in the number leaving. So, for example, there's about 1.5 million fewer Mexican undocumented immigrants in the country than in the past. Of course, if that population is falling, then so too is the population of undocumented workers.
Let's talk a little bit about gender and how that plays into this. We've seen a rise of women migrant laborers and a decline in male migrant workers. What's that about?
It's really a decline in the number of men, single men particularly, who have come to the United States without authorization and who are working in the country. Women, on the other hand, we've seen a slight increase over the last few years, and that partly reflects some of the different ways in which today's unauthorized immigrants are becoming unauthorized immigrants. For example, crossing the U.S.-Mexico border used to be the primary way that you would see unauthorized immigrants enter the country without authorization. Today, a greater share are people who overstay their visas, and that's a little bit more of a gender mix of men and women, and as a result, we've seen somewhat of an increase in the labor force participation and the number of undocumented women working in the labor force.
Kathleen, I want to turn to you for a second. We mentioned at the top the president's rhetoric around immigrants, but specifically undocumented workers, has been pretty intense. I want to play a clip and see what you think.
We believe jobs must be offered to American workers first. Does that make sense? Right now, widespread abuse in our immigration system is allowing American workers of all backgrounds to be replaced by workers brought in from other countries to fill the same job for sometimes less pay.
Kathleen, in that statement that migrant workers are taking Americans' jobs, is that an accurate assessment?
It's good rhetoric for sure, and it definitely plays to Trump's base, but no one really knows. You have to look at the jobs. You have to look under the hood of what U.S. employers are doing. A lot of these jobs are not living wage jobs. So you're asking U.S. workers to take jobs that they can't get by on, right? And so the economy is relying, this 5% of undocumented workers are filling jobs that are very low paid, very high risk, very dangerous. And it's really the employer having its cake and eating it too. Because if they can get away with paying very little, there's any kind of workplace violations, they're going to get away with it.
You mentioned the impact that this affects all American jobs and all American workers. Tell us a little bit more about that.
Sure. It's really kind of a race to the bottom. I mean, Trump's rhetoric, it's so double standard, right? Because Trump himself hires undocumented workers. Trump himself brings in temporary foreign guest workers, H-2A workers for his vineyards, H-2B workers for Mar-a-Lago. So he's bringing in foreign workers himself, like directly, actively, and not recruiting for workers, according to many reports for the temporary foreign guest workers. But at the same time, he's also employing people that don't have authorization. The issue really is it's not workers against workers. You just got to take a step back because I think some rhetoric you hear of there's no workers, U.S. workers to fill these jobs. It's just there's no definitive analysis that that's true in every job that's out there. It's just kind of this overall deteriorating, precarious workforce that is putting U.S. workers in a difficult situation. And if you have someone who is desperate for a job, they're going to work under very bad conditions. That's been the history of the United States.
I want to ask you, too, a little bit about, because I think, you know, the article in the New York Times was stunning with Trump's employee there, an undocumented worker. But I think it's just an example, and I think we've been sort of talking around this, of how corporations and very wealthy cities and neighborhoods really rely on undocumented workers to fill and survive, right? To fill a lot of these roles and survive. And I'm wondering, I see that in a city like New York. A lot of the lower level services that we use here, from delivery takeout to taxis to laundromats, some are documented, some are undocumented, but it really is a heavy immigrant workforce. Are these workers beginning to sort of come together to try and get better protections for themselves? Or is there any hope that they can create a union of sorts to, I mean, I'm thinking about the domestic workers union, for example. Like, do we see more of that on the horizon?
Sure. I think U.S. unions are now do organize. For a long time, U.S. unions were against undocumented workers and actively worked in immigration reform against them. But that has really changed, because 5% of the workforce is a significant amount of the workforce. So U.S. workers, for the most part, U.S. labor unions, for the most part, have embraced this and are organizing these workers. And I think it's, you know, it's a shadow economy that everybody knows about. Everybody knows that's there. Everybody benefits from it. You know, most people can say they know someone who is undocumented. But what's going on here is this acceptance of this exploitative culture is wrong. If we want those 5% of the workforce to have their papers and to have a really good shot at having a decent living, we should all be calling Congress and asking for legalization. It's completely unacceptable that that amount of numbers, which is bigger than some small countries, are people that are laboring in the shadows in precarious situations.
Kathleen Caron is the Executive Director of Justice in Motion, and Mark Hugo Lopez is the Director of Global Migration and Demography Research at Pew. Mark and Kathleen, thanks again.
Thank you.
Thank you.
This Friday, viewers across the country can open their streaming devices, log into Netflix, and hit play on Roma, a new film by Alfonso Cuarón, the director behind Gravity and Y Tu Mamá También. Roma is a very personal film for Cuarón, centering around an upper-middle-class family, much like the one he grew up in Mexico City in the early 1970s. But rather than focusing on the family itself, the movie is told mainly from the perspective of Cleo, the family's maid, played by Yalitza Aparicio. It's a point of view that viewers in the United States aren't really accustomed to, and the movie's depiction of class and race divisions in Latin America may also take some non-Latino viewers by surprise. Joining me now to discuss the film is Vanessa Erazo, film and television editor for Remezcla. Thanks for being with us, Vanessa.
Thank you for having me.
So overall, what stood out to you when you were watching the film?
Definitely the fact that the protagonist is an indigenous, darker-skinned woman who is, you know, working class and is a maid, and that she is the protagonist of the film is something that we don't see that in U.S. productions ever. In Latin American cinema, there's much more of a tradition of movies about domestic servants, because it's much more common to have a live-in maid in Latin America. Labor is so cheap that even middle class families have one or two. Like in the film, they have two actually live-in maids. So that, to me, that representation of an indigenous woman front and center was probably the thing that stood out the most to me.
And what do you make of Cuarón's decision to decenter his own story and really focus this on the help, essentially, Cleo, who's like you said, indigenous? I mean, does he handle her story thoughtfully or not?
I think there's two kind of parts to that. One, in a press conference that I attended where he was there, he talked about how in preparation for the film, he wanted it to be not only his memories, but kind of a coming together of his memories and of his real, you know, maid that he grew up with, nanny, almost second mother that he considered. So he obviously has a lot of love and affection for her. So he spent a lot of time on the phone, and he said, you know, I also wanted her memories of when she wasn't at the house, things that I didn't experience. So he really brought together both perspectives, and putting her front and center, I think, is a very bold choice, and it's a very noble effort. But I do think that ultimately, when he is the creative force behind the film, he's the one making choices of what to include, what not to include. I do think that ultimately it's through his lens. It is from his frame of reference for the world, even though she's the protagonist.
I want to ask you a little bit about that, because we mentioned Cuarón, all their Latino directors who are really in the spotlight, Guillermo del Toro, Alejandro Iñárritu. Where are the Latinas behind the camera?
I think it's important, one, to distinguish between directors from Latin America and also U.S.-born Latinos. Directors from Latin America are flourishing at film festivals, at the Oscars, you know, their cinema, because there is some funding from the national governments in Latin America, they have a chance to make movies that aren't commercially, you know, that's not their first priority. They're making art. So there is a woman who, Patricia Riggan, who is Mexican-born, who has made some movies in Hollywood. She made, there's a movie about the Chilean miners, The 33. She recently did a film with Jennifer Garner. So she's really the only, I would say, Latin American director that's been able to make movies in Hollywood, Latin American female, you know, Latina director. Mm-hmm. In terms of U.S.-born Latinos, male and female, they're not anywhere, you know, near the recognition that Latin American directors are. We don't have government money here for films that U.S. Latinos would make, particularly like fiction films. Documentaries, there's a little bit, you know, from public television. Mm-hmm. But they are really, if you look at Cannes, Venice, you know, the big festivals, Mexican directors are winning, Latin, you know, Argentine, Venezuelan. It's very, very rare to see a film about Latinos in the U.S. directed by, you know, U.S.-born Latinos, second-generation Latinos, to reach that level. It's right now, we're invisible, really, behind the camera.
I think we are, and we're also invisible in many of the critic roles when we're talking about this film. And I often think Latinos don't have to just be the only people talking about Latino films. Let's make that clear.
Right.
But I do think it is a hole in the art critic world that we don't have enough representation here. I'm wondering, when we talk about issues of class and colorism in Latin America, how were those portrayed in the film? And what do you think would stand out to non-Latino audiences, particularly here in the United States?
I think in this film in particular, it is subtle. They don't directly, let's say the family doesn't directly, you know, put her down for being indigenous or you know, make comments that you would think are insulting. But there's a small moment where one of the youngest boys, the two, you know, maids are talking in Mixteco to each other. And he keeps saying in Spanish, and like, what are you saying? What are you saying? Stop talking like that. Stop talking like that. You know, so that's kind of pointing out, right, that they speak this language that the family doesn't understand, and that there is a difference there. I think small things like that are what come across in the film, and also skin color, right? Like maybe to people who only watch movies made in the United States, we're kind of Latinos and Latin Americans are all lumped together, and there's one image projected of us that we all kind of had the same skin color, hair color. We all kind of look the same. But in Latin America, that's what very much stands out. I lived in Roma for a little bit in that neighborhood in Mexico City, and the people with money are very light-skinned, and the people that work for them are darker-skinned. That's very much very visible across all of Latin America, and I don't think a lot of you know, Anglo-Americans here would necessarily know that that's such a stark difference.
And in terms of, I mean, let's go a little deeper there, because there were a lot of racist comments on social media directed at the star of this film, Yalitza Aparicio, after she appeared in a Vanity Fair photo spread. Many of the comments came mostly from Mexican Twitter users. Did you make of this? I mean, we're talking about colorism here. What was your reaction to this?
To be honest, I wish I could say that I was shocked, but it, of course, is very disheartening, but it was not at all surprising. This is something that we know exists in Latin America, this attitude of, you know, just like there is in the United States, where there's a racial hierarchy in Latin America, in Mexico, this is very much the case, and left over from colonialism, the lighter the skin, the better. You know, so to me, it was upsetting, you know, to see that she's not allowed to just have her moment, especially from her own country people, right? People from Mexico feel very proud when they see Cuarón and Del Toro and Iñárritu winning Oscars. But an indigenous woman having a photo shoot with nice clothes and they have to put her down, I mean, that's really, it tells you how strong these divides are.
Vanessa Erazo is the film and television editor for Remezcla. Thank you so much for being with us, Vanessa.
Thank you for having me.
And that's our show for today. If you have any thoughts for us, you can give us a call at 877-8-MY-TAKE, or you can reach us on Twitter at The Takeaway. I'm Tanzina Vega. This is The Takeaway, and thanks so much for listening.
Hey, Takeaway listeners, Amy Walter here, host of Politics with Amy Walter from The Takeaway. Every week, I'll take you beyond the headlines for a deeper understanding of how Washington works, who's pulling the levers of power, and how it all impacts you. I hope you'll check it out. Just search for Politics with Amy Walter in your podcast app and subscribe. Happy listening.